Of you that are here, we have some meeting notes, which I will now share. I can find the right screen among many. And then let me post the link to that in the chat. And okay, always changes my screen when I share my screen. Okay, there we go. I think I'm set up now. Welcome to the Identity Implementers call this morning. As I mentioned, this will be a shorter call. Since our guest demo presenter is unavailable this morning and I wasn't able to get a follow-up. So if any of you would like to present how you're using identity in your respective companies and or products, feel free to send me a note. My name is McCown on Rocket Chat, and I'd be happy to get you set up. We're always looking for people to present so that this call serves as kind of an overview of what's going on in the community, plus an introduction to those that are new to the community as well. And so it's always good to show what cool things can be done.
Hey, Steve, would you like a demo today?
I would love one. Yeah.
I'm going to see if I can get Daniel Bloom to give us one. I'm talking with him on the back channel. So let's keep going, and I may, in a minute or two, we may have one ready.
Oh, that'd be awesome. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Yep.
So with these kind of calls, for those that are new, we are an industry group collaborating on some common technologies. And for all of our day jobs, we are in various different companies. And so we ask that you keep anything that is proprietary to your company, that you'd like to keep trade secret, that you're patenting or things like that, keep those technologies outside of this call, but feel free to share anything that you'd like to share with the overall community. And all right, so announcements this week. So on your screen, I'm showing the wiki page, which I've posted in the chat. Feel free to go in and sign your name on the attendees list, and that will let us know who's attending these calls, and also if we need to reach out for any particular reason, we'll have a way to contact you. By way of announcements, the next big upcoming identity activity is the Internet Identity Workshop, currently scheduled for April 28th through 30th in Mountain View, California, so Silicon Valley. I put the link there to the workshop. Due to the coronavirus, yeah, go ahead.
Well, no, you're saying it, probably.
Oh, yeah, due to the coronavirus, what's happened in Silicon Valley right now is all meetings over 1,000 people have been canceled for about 30 days. And so we're seeing Apple and Google and Facebook and all the big companies cancel conferences. I checked the FAQ page on the IIW yesterday. There's currently not a call to cancel the conference, but they're taking a wait and see attitude. Since it's a little further out than the 30 days, I think they haven't made the call whether they're going to cancel it. They also said that if they do need to cancel the in-person meeting, there's a chance they might look at a way to have that virtually online. But we don't know. I've personally made travel to attend, paid my fees and so forth. It's one of my favorite conferences. And so I'm looking forward to attending. But if the coronavirus issue doesn't work itself out by then IIW will present some more information and we'll figure out what to do from there.
I have been told that it will happen one way or another. So if it isn't happening physically in person, then it will turn into a virtual thing. And while it's hard to have the coffee guy there virtually for everybody, I'm confident that having something is better than having nothing.
Yeah, the coffee guy, I understand, has been there for like the last 20 conferences. So this will be a disruption for him. All right. So that's what I know that's going on right now. It'll be fun to have that virtually. This is one of the more creative conferences I've attended. So we'll look forward to that. Any other announcements of upcoming activities? I know the U.S. closed their borders to Europe last night for 30 days, so I'm not sure a lot of us will be attending any of the upcoming conferences in Europe right now. Anything anyone else is aware of? All righty. Let's see, let's go ahead and, so Daniel, I know you're joining us at the last minute to help give a demo due to a cancellation in our group. We really appreciate that. Since you're joining at the last minute, we can shuffle our agenda so it meets your schedule. Would you like to do it in the later half of the call as normal, or would you like to go ahead right now?
And the later half of the call would be good, because it is a little bit spur of the moment. I could use a little bit of time for prep.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, I just wanted to give you the option since you're pinch hitting for us, and that's awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
So let's go ahead and see what's happened in the various working groups this week. Did anyone attend the main identity working group?
Looks like the note in the wiki is updated. Well, no, I guess that's older, February 5th. But they have had some. I've been tracking the wiki because they do keep pretty good notes, and they've had some interesting topics recently covered. They've had guest speakers and things. So the last one was mid February, where they have the recording posted. And they did an update on what their plan is for future presentations. The one before that, they had a guest speaker early February about it's the IEEE person and Kim Cameron from Microsoft talking about identity. And that was a really good background. That's a video well worth watching.
Yeah, definitely so. I was able to meet Kim Cameron at the last IIW. Met him for the first time there. Very interesting individual. So the links are in the wiki right there to that working group, and you can get to his slides and presentation. All right. Anyone attend the Hyperledger Indie working groups? Probably plural.
Yeah, we had a couple really good sessions. Unfortunately, one of the recordings didn't work out, but they've been very productive work sessions. It's been the team at Evernim, the team at the Sovereign Foundation, the team at British Columbia, and occasionally the team from Kiva have all joined and said, we've been trading responsibilities. Who's working on revocation? Who's working on rich schemas? Who's working on bug fixes in the ledger? That's been really productive sessions. I'll tag on with the release plan. Indie node is, we didn't release in February. We're probably our current expectation is to move to a releasing every other month. Indie node, we did a lot of work on in 2019, and it's performing very well so far in 2020. And the pace of development is slowing. We're more worried about adoption, about Aries, about building client libraries, than we are about changing the ledger. And so expect Indie node to start releasing every other month. So we skipped February, we'll release in March. And of course, if development increases because somebody's contributing something cool, we'll release more often. We might find that we move to once a quarter if development slows further because it's working pretty well. The SDK, we've also slowed development. We've been much more focused on the Aries shared libraries. our main focus on the SDK, we try to get a February release out, found a bug at the last minute. That's fixed now. We're releasing our March release now. And but really our focus has been helping British Columbia and the Sovereign Foundation on the Aries Shared Libraries. So the Verifiable Data Registry, the VDR, the new Aries KMS. We'll talk more about these in a minute. And currently we're trying to get that work fed into libIndy. So essentially we're breaking libIndy apart. But to make it easy for people that are using libIndy to migrate, libIndy will call into these libraries instead of having everybody call into them directly. Eventually we'll deprecate libIndy probably, but that currently we're integrating things in so we can make sure that they're reliable, that they perform the same function libIndy used to. So that's the main goal for the next release. So March's release is all about Aries compatibility and libVCX. And then for April, May, we want to make sure that we're using the new Aries shared libraries. Those are the current efforts. And Rich Schemas is going into that as well. A quick update on Indy Catalyst that was contributed by British Columbia. It's going to move to Aries as the Aries Verifiable Credential Registry. My understanding is that renaming is underway. I do not have an update on the semantics working group, though. That might be something Ken can help with.
Thank you for that update. Ken, do you have any comments on the semantics group?
The last semantics meeting was held while I was at Hyperledger, so I don't have any comment on that.
Okay. Let's see, I do have a question for Indy. So those of you that are working specifically in those groups, maybe you can help the rest of us out here. On the All Stewards call, Phil Wendley mentioned that we're looking for to be able to enable public rights on the ledger, whereas currently rights need to go through a transaction author. I know that's kind of been talked about for a while, and that there are technical limitations and maybe legal ones as to why that's not been done so far. My question is, do any of you know how we're going to be able to enable that while keeping GDPR type information off the ledger? I'm just not in on those discussions, but it's something sure. I've been worried about.
This is Nathan. The transaction author agreement is really the mechanism by which an author of a transaction states their intent that the data is ready to go on an immutable ledger, that they agree that they have the right to put that data on the immutable ledger, and that they agree that that's what should be done with that data, is it should be retained for the purposes of meeting their obligations to other parties within the ecosystem, right? Which makes the data a matter of public record for contract enforcement, which is one of the clear exceptions for data retention under the GDPR. So whether you go through the permission channel or whether you go through the permissionless channel, you're still agreeing to that transaction author agreement, and you should be able to put that data on the ledger. Now, you're going to see a lot of Twitter dust up and controversy over what constitutes private identifiers and over what constitutes data that's subject to right to be forgotten and what's not subject to right to be forgotten. The idea behind the transaction author agreement is it means that you have explicitly agreed to the terms of the data retention on the ledger. And even if someone does something that's a bit messy, meaning that the legal ambiguities have not been fully resolved, we have sufficient cover under the transaction author agreement that the data can be retained. The part that hasn't been totally resolved is what happens when somebody maliciously signs the transaction author agreement, meaning they have no intent of meeting any of the conditions of the transaction author agreement, but they sign it anyway. We have some ideas on how we can handle redacting that data, because it obviously didn't meet the terms of use that they agreed to when they placed the data on the ledger, but the mechanical process of this, and the governance process for deciding that and then taking action on that is going to need some more work. So hopefully people are patient with the transaction author agreement, that you have to integrate that into what you're doing. It is important for these GDPR reasons. And then we will be monitoring the ledger's rights like we always do to be cognizant of what might happen when something malicious would happen, because we have ideas on how we can handle that. We just would rather wait to build some of those things until they're needed.
You're also going to see the transaction author agreement in play in the demo that Daniel's about to give. So that should add some color.
Excellent. Thank you. Yeah. That has been a concern of mine, depending on how that's opened up, what a malicious party would do. And then more importantly, how the ledger would recover. So I'm glad we're all giving that some serious thought to work that out, because I would love to see the day when individuals can write to the ledger, but I'd like to have a rogue not destroy the ledger in the process by writing PII information there.
So this is Dan. No, this is really good, but this is specific to Sovereign, not Indy as a ledger. This is specific to Sovereign's implementation and trust framework or a guardianship of that ledger, right?
Yes and no, right? It is the way the Sovereign Foundation has decided as a community that we should address this issue on the public ledger. But it's also very important to anyone who's trying to run this kind of identity ledger because of the constraints of GDPR. So even if you were running a private consortium network of Indy, you would face similar issues, and you'd need to make sure that you address this idea of GDPR compliance for hashed data.
Well, 100% agree, but the specifics of a transaction author agreement is part of Sovereign's value add, let's say, right?
It is, but the mechanisms that allow Sovereign to do it are open and available for anyone, meaning any ledger can specify what should be in their transaction author agreement. The contents of the agreement is specific to Sovereign, but anyone can implement a transaction author agreement and use similar mechanisms if they don't, for some reason, want to use the Sovereign ledger.
Gotcha. So, okay, that's important, I think.
So there's two pieces, right? There's the technical support for what needs to happen, and that's available in Indy. And generally speaking, and then you have the application of those technologies in a specific way, and that's been done within Sovereign, but that could also be done on other ledgers if you desire to change or something different.
Gotcha, okay.
And there's...
Sorry, this is Venu. I'm kind of new to this group, but so are you talking about metadata written to the ledger, or are you talking about PII written to the ledger? When I say metadata, I'm talking about DIDs and keys and things like that.
Yeah, from my perspective, what I'm looking for, DIDs being written to the ledger is something that I understand the sovereign attorneys are working that out with specifically the European Union, because GDPR is kind of the elephant in the room in that regard. Really, it can be, so we're talking about PII. My real concern was whether someone maliciously wrote someone's, passport number onto the ledger, and what we would do, how we would prohibit that, what we would do. And right now, transaction authors are more kind of larger entities, companies that write data on users' behalf. And so they, as Nathan mentioned, they sign an agreement stating that they won't put that type of information. And so my question was more looking at when individuals are able to write directly, what are the limitations and recourses? And as Dan points out, this kind of is specifically a sovereign implementation at this point, but the reality is, for any public ledger, they're going to come up against this position. My personal opinion is things like Bitcoin and Ethereum, where they have all sorts of PII, personal data information, on their ledgers. I think that just kind of hasn't been openly and officially addressed yet, but I think the day is coming. So that's why I'm glad we're preparing for that.
But if you talk about specifically Indy, I mean, unless some end user is using libindy and then directly writing to the ledger using some kind of a library call, if they're using an application like a wallet or an agent, then that should not happen, right? I mean, they basically put the correct right kind of information to the ledger. But are you talking about somebody using libindy directly? I'm trying to understand what is the concern.
Well, it's not that... If you're using libindy, for example, it's going to be doing the right things. But if you use part of libindy, for example, to prepare a transaction, but then instead of writing a key or when you were including an endpoint, you instead put some other information that was not an endpoint there, then you'd have to very intentionally do that. No one can accidentally write something, you know, into the wrong place. But if you did, then it would end up on the ledger. So even if it was maliciously applied there, it would. So the concern is to cover the legal base for people that are intentionally malicious. A whole lot of bases have been covered, and Nathan highlighted the one that we're still working on. But that's the concern. No one that's using libindy is going to accidentally write PII to the ledger. It's not written in a way that's possible.
And I want to clarify the remediations. Once you've handled the liability issue, there's time to handle the remediation issue.
Yeah, and I think it's worth clarifying exactly what Indy's behavior is. Today, when you try to write to an Indy network, Indy has a very flexible permission scheme, and you can configure a variety of different behaviors. On the sovereign network, they've enabled it so that an endorser has to endorse every transaction author's write. So the endorser can check and say, there's no PII in here, nobody has a problem. But Indy does support, and Indy has a very flexible way to say when an endorser is required, when an endorser is not required. It can do multi-signature, things like that. So every deployment of Indy can configure those permissions in the way that's right for them. The concern that the sovereign networks had is the stewards say, well, but how do we make sure that somebody doesn't hold us responsible for something that's on the ledger? If they exercise the right to be forgotten, we have no way to honor that request, and GDPR has penalties. So even though we think it's highly unlikely that personal data ends up on the ledger, we still need to tell stewards how they're protected. And the transaction author agreement allows there to be an agreement in place between the transaction author and the network as a whole that says, I'm not going to do this. And if I do it, I know that I don't have a right to be forgotten because it's an indelible ledger. And that gives those stewards that cover that for a transaction author to exercise the right to be forgotten, they have to claim a transaction on the ledger that they want removed. And there's clear evidence that they agreed to the agreement when they submitted that transaction. So it's kind of a legal, the odds of this having to be needed in practice are very low, but it's an important legal comfort for stewards to say, I'm engaged in a network where I don't have the ability to delete stuff. And now, and this is how I can be protected so that I don't get unnecessary risk for my organization.
Yeah, I'd just like to point out the way the ledger is set up today with specific transaction authors, these issues are they're covered, and the risk of anything like this happening is extremely low. My concern was not related to the way the network is today, but if we open up for individuals to have public rights to the ledger, that's the nature of my question. So this is a forward-thinking risk analysis I was looking at. So we're pretty good today.
And even in the future, like Venu pointed out, Indy's going to make it difficult to put stuff on the ledger that shouldn't be there. But if somebody really wanted to, they could put custom data in a trib, and then they could come back and say, hey, ledger, you're violating my rights. And so we need a way to make sure that person, when they come back, they say, well, I did agree that I couldn't remove stuff when I submitted this.
Well, and for the implementer group, this is an important point that as we move to the new data model with rich schemas, we want to refactor some things about how NIM transactions work so that we can validate a DID doc collectively as opposed to having independent or atomic transactions. So that will let us do the validation of a TRIBS collectively and prevent attributes that aren't part of what's needed for a valid DID document. And that will eliminate most of that risk as well. So, you know, all this stuff is part of the development roadmap. And this is one of the reasons why Richard has been advocating for help in, you know, upgrading the ledger and building some of these new releases, because the more of us participate, the faster we can address these risks.
But even on Indy, right, nobody else can put information on your DID. I mean, it's the DID owner can put information.
Right.
But other people, I mean, unless you hack into it, of course.
Well, and that's one of the reasons why the transaction author agreement is written the way it is, right? It's that you're agreeing that you do want that data on the ledger. Though at the same time, if we don't allow you to write correlatable attributes, unless you are a steward or a trustee on the network, those are the only two organizations that should have a need to write any anything in an attrib, and those attribs are just the real organization name and the legal name of the trustee. We shouldn't be writing any other data beyond that, so we would like the validation rules to cover that.
Yeah. Under the current iteration of GDPR, the DID owner has the right to withdraw their consent to have that on the ledger. But of course, distributed ledgers, blockchain technology makes that very difficult. So we want to make that clear to the transaction authors.
Well, and again, that's one of the really important parts about the transaction author agreement is we don't want people writing those other types of correlatable data on the ledger because they wouldn't have a legal basis for us retaining that data if they decided to withdraw their consent. However, when someone is anchoring a DID at saying this cryptographic key is the issuer of contracts or the issuer of credentials that are being exchanged peer-to-peer in the network, they no longer have a legal basis to withdraw that data under the GDPR unilaterally because all those other parties are also have a vested stake in that data being retained. And that's why the transaction author agreement works from a legal perspective. You've said, I am going to be the issuer of credentials to lots of parties that are all going to be using this public ledger in order to validate those credentials. Therefore, if you come back later and say, I want to write to be forgotten my credential definition, it clearly is something we can say, no, we're not forgetting that because you agreed that we all get to retain this because it's part of contract enforcement.
Very good. Thank you for all the discussion. This helps me. Hopefully it helps the others as well. For those that want to follow up on this topic, where's the best working group or Rocket Chat channel to follow up? That'd be
The Sovereign and Governance Framework Working Group is where most of the conversation around GDPR compliance happens. They just approved version 2 and they're started to talk about what they should do for version 3. But really, for people who want to get started, the resource I recommend is at sovereign.org. There's a library, and in that library, there's a bunch of white papers around GDPR compliance. It's called Innovation Meets Compliance. It's a great position paper. What goes on the ledger explains what is intended to be there and what shouldn't. Those two items are probably the most important for this topic.
When Richard says library, he means document library, not code library.
Yes. sovereign.org/library. It's a URL. Thanks, Sam.
Excellent. Thank you. All right. Let's move on to Hyperledger Aries. Any new developments this week?
Really good conversations about the DID exchange protocol and things like signed attachments and other mechanisms that we need in place. And so there's some PRs that are there that will get updated, and it looks like we're progressing relatively rapidly in that direction. Note that there's a parallel effort for the next sort of version that the Aries effort will be doing, and the also under development DID exchange protocol for the DIDCOM working group inside of the DIF. So that's a bit of a longer term thing, and we're seeking to move a little faster in Aries. So if you recognize a parallel effort, there is in fact one on purpose. That's my piece. Richard?
Yeah, we did a number of, like Sam said, we've had great collaboration conversations. The out-of-band RFC has been really interesting for my team because we've been working on a different implementation, and it was cool to find out the BC Gov's doing their out-of-band stuff, and we're synchronizing, harmonizing those efforts for connection reuse and other situations where we want to change what protocol you're speaking. We spent a lot of time on the Aries shared libraries. Mike Lauder presented his thinking about how an Aries key management service should look. It takes into account the need for security in the keys, but also the benefits of being able to, you don't want keys to be able to leave the key management service unless it's going to a hardware enclave. But there's some interesting trade-offs to say, yes, you can use a hardware enclave, but that means things can leave that couldn't leave before. So we talked about how we can manage those concerns. There has not been too many changes on the protocol test suite. Hopefully people can contribute some additional tests there for Aries interop compatibility around profile 1.0 and the new stuff. But most of the work that I've been engaged in is around splitting apart libindi and creating an indie verifiable data registry that is compatible with other a ledger that is compatible with the Aries interface for VDRs that any ledger can implement. Pulling out credential exchange. Some of that will be Indy specific in CredEx, the way revocation works. And a lot of that will be Aries general, Aries CredEx. So we have two new libraries, Indy CredEx and Aries CredEx. Pulling out utility functions like pack unpack, that'll go into an Aries util. Adding the rich schema work, which will be in the CredEx libraries and the VDR. And then creating these Aries KMS key management service and Aries data storage, data persistence libraries. So we can have a place to manage keys, but we also have a place to manage credentials, protocol state, all the other things that are involved. So that architecture of Aries shared libraries is finally taking place, finally taking shape. And each one will provide a Rust API and a ccallable API. They're written in Rust. And a ccallable API that'll allow foreign function interfaces to the various language-specific Aries frameworks. And then over time, the Aries frameworks can use these instead of using libindy. And that's our path for moving into this new architecture.
Excellent. Thank you for that overview. I also attended Mike's presentation on the KMS, so it was really good. It goes into a fair amount of detail on cryptography and where keys need to go, but it's done at a higher level. So if cryptography is not your forte, it's very understandable. So he's done a number of really good presentations like that lately. So I don't see Mike on the call today. Any IRSA updates? We kind of just talked about it with Mike's KMS work.
Yeah, there is a meeting, I think, right after this for sovereign. It's a sovereign crypto meeting on trusted execution environments and HSMs. That discussion is going forward really well. There was also a lot of action at the Hyperledger Global Forum around how to integrate IRSA into various platforms and various settings and situations. And obviously, we've already talked a little bit about that with some of the Aries work that's happening. I think the biggest call to action there is just we need more boots on the ground or more developers helping with the Aries integration and the Aries credentials exchange libraries and other pieces that are needed in order to fully expose the new functionality that's available in IRSA.
Excellent. Thank you. Any sovereign updates before we give Daniel some time to demo?
So related to IRSA, the sovereign crypto call has moved from Mondays to Thursdays. So anybody who's interested in those discussions, look for them on Thursdays.
So the updates on the sovereign side, obviously funding continues to be an issue for the Sovereign Foundation team in order to support the work that everyone's doing. So if you know of organizations that are able to donate or willing to donate, please reach out to them and we'll get them connected with Anna at the Sovereign Foundation in order to help us keep doing what we're doing. The transaction author agreement rollout has been underway. So if you're not following along with that, you can join us on chat.sovereign.org. And most of the announcements have been going to both the stewards channel and the general channel. So if you want to follow along with what's going on with that update and getting that turned on, you can follow along there. You should expect to see that fully in effect and activated. I know there was some issues with some of the transaction signing when it was supposed to roll out earlier this week. I don't know what the current status of that is. But like I say, if you're following along in those channels, you'll be watching those updates in real time.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
And I did update the agenda with the latest note from Lynn, which is that the TAA should be enforced on mainnet. He's shooting for today at right now, 9 a.m. Mountain. So that should be enforced today.
Okay, great. All right, any other discussion items before we move on to Daniel's demo? All right, Daniel, I think we're ready for you if you're ready to go. I'll stop sharing my screen.
Okay, sounds good. All right. Since this is definitely a little spur of the moment, if anybody has questions, please feel free to interrupt me or Nathan/Sam feel free to make further clarifications if you find that I'm leaving something out or anything. So just to give a brief overview of what we're looking at here. So in this terminal window, I have a Docker Compose running, which is running four different containers. Two are ACPI agents. The other two are just a tunneling service so we can get them to talk easier. That Docker Compose setup is available inside of the Aries ACPI plugin toolbox repository, which is our kind of corresponding repository that we've been filling out the toolbox with of late. And then here is the toolbox, which is a development tool for those creating agents. It operates over a agent messaging API, which can be implemented by any agent. So not just the ACPI plugin that we've been using. If you want to come in and implement the same protocols for connections or invitations or whatever, you can do that within your agent and then gain all the advantages of using the toolbox for your agent. So I've copied a couple of invitations out of the Docker Compose window here. So we have an Alice and a Bob agent available to run, and I'll pull those open real fast. So the first thing that you see popping up here is the transaction author agreement that we were just talking about. Because making payments on the Sovereign Ledger right now does require a transaction author agreement. We will need to review and accept the terms of the agreement for the both of them. So then toolbox, I've given a lot of demos on this, so I won't get too much into details of how this works and just focus on payments today. So this payments interface is pretty basic at the moment. This is kind of our first pass, and we anticipate having a little bit more functionality to it in the future. So what it supports right now is creating an address and then transferring whatever unit of payment you're using. We designed the protocol that backs this payment interface to be hopefully able to easily integrate with other payment interfaces, even though we've targeted the sovereign test tokens for this first pass. I expect we'll probably need some minor modifications to better support others, but we've tried our best to leave the door open for other payments. Let's see. So yeah, I'll go ahead and create an address on Alice. You can specify the payment method, and we're going to use SOV. And I won't specify a seed for now and just create an address. And displayed here, we have the actual payment address itself, and it'll display the balance, the method, and this sources, this JSON structure here is kind of debug information that's returned by the connected agent. And we'll see in a second some more interesting information filled out into this sources section. So in order to receive sovereign test tokens, we can use the sovereign self-serve application that's available on the internet. So we'll copy out the payment address, and I'll switch to the self-serve app, which is selfserve.sovereign.org. And then we just paste in our payment address into this interface, making sure that we specify the staging net since the toolbox and the ACPI plugin demo is using the staging net today. And then we can just hit submit. And we can see that we are successfully transferred a large number of Sovatoms, which totals to about 2,000 sovereign tokens. And then if we go back to the toolbox, because that transaction occurred on the ledger without a direct interaction between the connected agent, we actually need to manually trigger a refresh in order to get the current balance of that payment address. In the future, when we have DIDCOM protocols that negotiate the exchange of payment, we can automatically trigger that update so you don't have to be watching the ledger constantly. You can kind of get a notification that, hey, this is probably updated, and so I'll go and, and check the value that's on the ledger. But now we can see here that we have 2,000 tokens. And if we want to check out the a bit of debug information, this is actually the backing transaction for these 2,000 tokens for this payment address. And this is retrieved from the ledger. Okay, so I'm going to demonstrate transferring tokens from Alice to Bob. So I'm going to go ahead and create a payment address for Bob. Again, a payment method of SOV. And I'll leave the seat blank. New payment address is created. And then we just click on transfer here. Then again, specify the payment method, the address we want to transfer from. We're going to pick this one since it's got, well, it's our only one for one thing, but we can also see that a balance is included with a bit of not the best styling there yet, but there we go. Then we can copy the payment address out of our Bob side, paste that in, specify an amount, let's say 11, I guess. And then we can check any fees associated with this transaction. So the sovereign test tokens, the fee for a transfer of tokens is constant. So it will always be one token. Well, until it will not always be one, but it's not a variable fee, meaning it's not a percentage of the amount being transferred. The fees can change, to be abundantly explicit, but built into the payment protocol that we've created is support for fees that are potentially a percentage of the amount being transferred. So now that we've checked the fees, we can see that it's changed to a transfer button. And then we can click that. We get a little notification that 11 tokens were transferred. And we can refresh on the Bob side. And we see our tokens have now appeared. And on this side, we can see that 12 tokens, the 11 transferred plus the fee, have been deducted from our original balance. And we can see that the source for our funds has changed slightly since there was a single source. There is the balancing act that goes on in similar systems with unspent transaction output balance models like Bitcoin, where we completely consumed the original transaction and then created another transaction source that we can view from this side for the amount of 11 tokens. And then we paid ourselves back the remainder of that original transaction. And that's what's going on there. And that's about the extent of what we have so far. So are there any questions? Any comments? Those are fine too.
Where does the fee token get transferred to?
You know, I'm honestly not sure. That's a good question.
So the fee token gets acknowledged on the ledger in the transactions, and then there's a different mechanism for gathering the fees, where you look, it goes through and marks which transactions have had fees collected and which ones haven't. So if you go look at the TXOs that are available on the ledger, you can count up what fees are on, quote unquote, on the ledger but not distributed yet. A couple of things to point out here. This is not the only way to deal with tokens or test tokens. ConnectMe has had some functionality for doing some token testing for quite some time. This is really kind of a debug interface that we wanted to expose to help people get a good feel for how tokens will work in various kinds of agents, and also help people prototype value transfer as part of the credential governance that they're building out for all sorts of different use cases across the network. So the hope here is that this gives you some of the basic tools to make sure you can get tokens into your credentials exchange use cases and try out how that changes the governance of your credentials systems, and how you can use payments in conjunction with your credentials exchange to make sure that value transfer and information transfer happen in conjunction with one another.
So is this related to monetizing credentials? And
yeah, it definitely can be related to monetizing credentials. So we've talked about for a long time the idea that a holder of a credential might pay the issuer to get that credential, or a verifier might pay the holder in order to get the proof based on that credential. The most common use case you see for this is the idea of a university, college, or a college transcript. The registrar's office at a university usually charges some money in order to get a signed version of that data. So this helps you get the people in the ecosystem bought in to sharing information that they might not share if there's not value transfer in association with sharing that data.
But have you considered the case where the verifier has to pay the issuer?
Yes, not the holder. In that case, there's actually a pretty good paper on the cryptography involved and how that will work. We have not enabled that in the protocol in the first version, but the idea that we call it a premium credential or a locked credential, and you have to have the issuer or the a delegate of the issuer, we would call a toll booth, accept the payment in order to be able to unlock the proof. So the cryptography for that is ready to go. We want people to experiment and play with the value transfer for the peer-to-peer communications use case first, because we want to make sure that the economics of the system stays stable and that the privacy of the system is preserved. Because if you off the bat introduce the idea that the verifier has real-time communications with the issuer, you can destabilize the three-party model of a credentials exchange system and make it so that things like zero-knowledge proofs or selective disclosure become less important in the system. And that would make it so that a lot of the work to do verifiable credentials in the first place wouldn't be as valuable.
Right, that's what I'm asking, because I know there are use cases like that came out that I have talked to people about, like, you know, monetizing KYC in case of banks, background checks and things like that.
The tools for that should all be available in the ecosystem now. There's a few things that we need to do to turn on all those switches, and one of those things is we need to get to where pages in general support the payment decorators, and we need to make it so that peer-to-peer value transfer is a stable feature of the system before we try to make it so that verifier pays issuer is introduced. Like I say, you don't want to create correlation problems, and you don't want to make it so the system defaults to correlating between the verifier and the issuer.
So Nathan, if I characterize this correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this is the first step towards more sound and thorough testing of the capability that's been on the network, on the staging network for some time. This allows you to look in and debug and start doing things. Then the next step would probably be to start applying payment decorators on each of the protocols that we're enabling on the network.
Yeah, and in fact, you see that in what Daniel talked about with the development work, right? We've got payment addresses and balances and transfers working here, and this UI is really basic. We do not have the payment decorator and direct messaging working. But the next thing that this should do is, when I initiate a transfer, is I should send a message from Alice to Bob saying, "Hey, Bob, I sent you the money." That way this could automatically notify and refresh the balance.
Well, in addition to when you're, we've talked about the writing transactions to the ledger independent of a transaction author or a steward. And this would this will also enable that. If you're writing a DID, you can either be a steward and have that permission, or you can include some payment for doing so onto the network. And so that is also something that we haven't yet built yet.
And is this Sovereign or Indy? I mean, you're talking about Sovereign.
This is Sovereign, which is an implementation of Indy, right?
Right, no, I understand.
Yeah, so the other thing specifically about Sovereign, the payment interface in Indy is generic, and any crypto asset should, in theory, be able to plug into that interface. Now, there's some reasons why putting it on the ledger natively was important for us, because it lets you process things in a more atomic way. You can make sure that the settlement on revocation registries and the settlement on payments happens in conjunction with each other. The idea here is that this method, the pay colon and then the method, just like the DID method spec, it could allow for other kinds of assets to be plugged into this interface too. So that's another area where someone can do some experimentation and maybe come up with something that's pretty cool.
So have you considered the case where the credentials can be changed by the time you verify? Things like KYC, where the information in that can be very time sensitive.
Yeah, so that's part monetized. Of why the native token on the Sovereign ledger is important for us, because we want the revocation on the credentials presented to be something that happens in conjunction with the finality of the payment transfer. So, the idea is that you know at what exact point of time the revocation occurred, and you know what exact point of time the payment occurred. Otherwise, you know, when you have a blockchain that has probabilistic finality, like anything that's a public permissionless system, it's hard to make that check work in a practical way for something like a KYC or AML check, like you described.
But you are basically considering all of this to happen on the ledger. I mean, what if the payments are off ledger?
If the payments are off ledger, you have to do some sort of cross-anchoring step where you include hashes across both sides. It means that you end up introducing hash data onto the ledger that causes additional correlation. And it makes the system slower, and it's possible to do that. Now, you'll also notice that we haven't done anything to fully blind the payment addresses on the ledger in this cut. The expectation is eventually we can turn on ZK-SNARK protected balance addresses. That's part of why the transaction fee for transferring a token is a fixed flat fee, because we don't want the value of the fee to correlate you as to what balances were inside the addresses during the transfer. Obviously, with this first token plugin, that's not as much of an issue because it's really just doing the basic Bitcoin UTXO model. But the idea is that as we get through the legal requirements for the basis governance framework and then the governance frameworks that sit on top, we can turn on those privacy preserving features in a way that's legally compliant across jurisdictions.
Okay. So you're still considering all of this at the identity level? I mean, or at a different...
So the idea is that you want KYC data and legal compliance data to happen in conjunction with value transfer. You want those things to happen together because that helps you for auditing. It helps you for compliance reasons. It helps you for cross-jurisdictional issues. And when you do this type of value transfer in the identity system, it's much better and it's much easier to do those things than when you try to tack them on to a value transfer system.
Right, but value transfers can be relevant in a lot of other use cases, right? So this is one such instance. So I was basically thinking about doing value transfer as a layer on top of the identity with hooks into one case being verification or issue of a credential.
Yep. All those things be possible, and those are things that we hope people start experimenting with and talking about.
Okay.
Thank you, Daniel. This is really exciting to see.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, Daniel, thank you for joining us, especially at the last minute, and for giving such a compelling demo regarding payments. So in the wiki page, down at the bottom under open discussion, we've referenced Daniel giving a demo of the Aries toolbox today. And I've put a link in there. If you would like to download the toolbox and set up and duplicate this demo on your own systems, you can download all the source code and follow the instructions to set up that environment. Thank you all for joining today. Very much appreciate all the good discussion and all the summaries. Thank you for joining. And our next meeting, we meet every 2 weeks. So we will be meeting again on March the 26th, Mountain Time in the US. And look forward to everybody joining at that time. Thank you very much and hope you all have a great day.
Thanks, you too.